This is the listening part of your Year 12 exam in English. It will consist of three tasks. You will hear the texts twice. Task 1. You have a minute to read the task.
Today, we're going to talk about studying. Yeah, you do a lot of it because you're in school right now.
Yeah, I'm right in the thick of it. I guess this is my fourth semester of my master's degree, and I study all the time.
I went to the University of Alberta, and I did my bachelor's degree in political science. And then when I moved to Montreal, I went to McGill, and I did a certificate in human resources.
Human resources. What made you decide to switch from poli-sci to HR?
I couldn't really find a job in anything related to political science.
The classic story, yeah.
And you've done a bachelor's degree, and now you're doing a master's, right?
Yeah, I studied history and English before, and now I'm studying linguistics. So I also did a change from my BA to my grad studies. Yeah.
How long has it been since you finished your bachelor's degree to when you started your master's?
I took 3 years off in between my BA and my MA.
And what do you find the differences are, like in terms of studying and different ways of learning?
One thing that I've really noticed is that I don't have to write as much for my master's degree. And I'm not talking about writing papers because I do that a ton now. But I'm talking about physically writing. Before, I had to always take notes in class. I was writing like crazy. I had a callus on my finger from where my pen hit my finger because I would write so much. But now, everything is electronic. If I do take notes in class, I just type them up. And that even doesn't happen very often because all of my professors put their notes, their PowerPoint slides on the internet. So I can just see them up there.
Ah, yes. I actually experienced the same thing. But I remember having to write so many notes and the same thing, having a callus where you would just write and write and write in class.
Yeah. And now if I do have to write something like an exam or a quiz in class, it really shocks me because I'm like, why am I doing this? Like my hand doesn't know what to do. It gets cramped up after a couple minutes. It's really pathetic. And it's sort of sad, like we're losing the art of writing and my handwriting now is super sloppy and I'm always afraid that the professors can't read it. But it's just the way that things are going. We're switching to the electronic note taking.
Yeah, I wonder if there's ever going to be a time where we're writing our exams on computers at school.
Well, a lot of my quizzes that I do have to take are online now and I just take them whenever I want. There's a window, like a 24-hour window, and I just log in and write the quiz at my house.
Wow, so much has changed since I was in university.
There is something to be said for the physical act of taking notes. I think it helps me remember stuff. So especially when I'm studying, I like to physically write out things, but I never read that again. You know, I just write it and then throw it out just to get it in my brain.
Yeah, I'm the same as you. I learn by writing. So when I was in school, I used to write a lot of notes even after, like I would summarize what the teacher said or I would summarize what was in my textbook. Now, I want to go back to this taking quizzes online.
Sure.
Okay, because I was thinking when I was asking the question of whether we're going to have computers where people are going to take exams is, that it'll be easier to cheat. Now, do you have your textbook there and you can just take as long as you want, or how does it work?
You are allowed to have your textbook. There's no real way that the teacher can stop you from just checking in your book. But so let's say I'm writing a quiz and it's a 25-minute quiz. As soon as I hit the link to get into that quiz, in the top corner, there's a big countdown clock that just slowly counts down. And it's the most stressful thing. Doing these quizzes online is way worse than in person. In person, it's chill. You're with all your friends, your sort of, or your classmates, you're in it together. But when you're by yourself in front of this computer and it's just the countdown clock, it's super stressful.
That does actually sound really stressful.
And if you have only 25 minutes, having the book there is worse too, because you're like, I don't need to study. I got this. I have the book. But then the countdown clock goes on and you're like flipping through your book trying to find the answer. And yeah, it's no good.
Okay, so you have to study in advance still.
Yeah, I learned that lesson the hard way one time. I think it's better just to know your stuff if you can. Yeah. Get it down.
You have a minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
Today, we're going to talk about studying. Yeah, you do a lot of it because you're in school right now.
Yeah, I'm right in the thick of it. I guess this is my fourth semester of my master's degree, and I study all the time.
I went to the University of Alberta and I did my bachelor's degree in political science. And then when I moved to Montreal, I went to McGill and I did a certificate in human resources.
Human resources. What made you decide to switch from poli-sci to HR?
I couldn't really find a job in anything related to political science.
The classic story. Yeah.
And you've done a bachelor's degree and now you're doing a master's, right?
Yeah. I studied history and English before and now I'm studying linguistics. So I also did a change from my BA to my grad studies. Yeah.
How long has it been since you finished your bachelor's degree to when you started your master's?
I took 3 years off in between my BA and my MA.
And what do you find the differences are, like in terms of studying and different ways of learning?
One thing that I've really noticed is that I don't have to write as much for my master's degree. And I'm not talking about writing papers because I do that a ton now. But I'm talking about physically writing. Before, I had to always take notes in class. I was writing like crazy. I had a callus on my finger from where my pen hit my finger because I would write so much. But now, everything is electronic. If I do take notes in class, I just type them up. And that even doesn't happen very often because all of my professors put their notes, their PowerPoint slides on the internet. So I can just see them up there.
Ah, yes. I actually experienced the same thing. But I remember having to write so many notes and the same thing, having a callus where you would just write and write and write in class.
Yeah. And now if I do have to write something like an exam or a quiz in class, it really shocks me because I'm like, why am I doing this? Like my hand doesn't know what to do. It gets cramped up after a couple minutes. It's really pathetic. And it's sort of sad, like we're losing the art of writing and my handwriting now is super sloppy and I'm always afraid that the professors can't read it. But it's just the way that things are going. We're switching to the electronic note taking.
Yeah, I wonder if there's ever going to be a time where we're writing our exams on computers at school.
Well, a lot of my quizzes that I do have to take are online now and I just take them whenever I want. There's a window, like a 24-hour window, and I just log in and write the quiz. at my house.
Wow, so much has changed since I was in university.
There is something to be said for the physical act of taking notes. I think it helps me remember stuff. So especially when I'm studying, I like to physically write out things, but I never read that again. You know, I just write it and then throw it out just to get it in my brain.
Yeah, I'm the same as you. I learn by writing. So when I was in school, I used to write a lot of notes even after. Like I would summarize what the teacher said, or I would summarize what was in my textbook. Now I want to go back to this taking quizzes online.
Sure.
Okay, because I was thinking when I was asking the question of whether we're going to have computers where people are going to take exams, is that it'll be easier to cheat. Now, do you have your textbook there and you can just take as long as you want, or how does it work?
You are allowed to have your textbook. There's no real way that the teacher can stop you from just checking in your book. But so let's say I'm writing a quiz and it's a 25-minute quiz. As soon as I hit the link to get into that quiz, in the top corner, there's a big countdown clock that just slowly counts down. And it's the most stressful thing. Doing these quizzes online is way worse than in person. In person, it's chill. You're with all your friends, you're sort of, or your classmates, you're in it together. But when you're by yourself in front of this computer and it's just the countdown clock, it's super stressful.
That does actually sound really stressful.
And if you have only 25 minutes, having the book there is worse too, because you're like, I don't need to study. I got this. I have the book. But then the countdown clock goes on and you're like flipping through your book trying to find the answer. And yeah, it's no good.
Okay, so you have to study in advance still.
Yeah, I learned that lesson the hard way one time. I think it's better just to know your stuff if you can. No. Get it down.
There is half a minute now to finish the task.
This is the end of task one. Go on to task two. You have a minute to read the task.
Not many scientific studies begin like this.
Many hours of watching YouTube clips, trying to find as many yawns as possible.
But for Andrew Gallup, an evolutionary psychologist who studies yawning at the State University of New York, it was all in a day's work. Gallup says yawns have traditionally been known as a sign of sleepiness or boredom.
But recent evidence suggests that yawning may function to promote brain cooling.
The idea being, when you breathe in deeply, the incoming air slightly cools the brain. And stretching the jaw increases blood flow to the brain, too. The reason we do it at night?
At nighttime, when we're about to go to sleep, our brain and body temperatures are at their highest point during the day, and that's when we see highest frequency of yawning.
And so, Gallup and his colleagues found themselves hunting for cat videos on the internet. Along with clips of dogs, foxes, elephants, gorillas, hedgehogs, squirrels, rats, even walruses yawning. They timed all those yawns and then compared them to each species' average brain weight. Their conclusion, published in Biology Letters, was that the length of a yawn was a remarkably good predictor of an animal's brain weight, regardless of the size of its skull or jawbone.
Psychologist Saho Takagi, a graduate student at Kyoto University in Japan, strolls into one of Japan's many cat cafes. But Takagi isn't a typical customer. She's not there for feline affection, but to probe their minds. The psychology of domestic cats is still something of a mystery, despite our overwhelming familiarity with the critters. They have many skills, she tells me through an interpreter, that are not well known even to their owners. Takagi and her colleagues wanted to see whether domestic cats have an intuitive understanding of cause and effect. The cats, 30 of them, were shown a series of demonstrations. For example, a researcher would shake a box, accompanied by the sound of an object bouncing around inside. Then the cat would be allowed to see inside the container. If the cat expects to find a ball inside the box, it should stare longer if the box turns out to be empty, rather than if the ball was there as expected. If they expected a ball and were surprised not to find one, or vice versa, it suggests that cats have certain expectations about the physical realities of the world. And the cats did stare longer at those containers that violated their expectations, as if to suggest that they realized that something in the situation was amiss. Takagi suspects that this ability might be related to cats' hunting skills. Despite years of domestication, we initially kept them around as a form of pest control, so it makes sense that cats would have retained their knack for hunting. Eventually, she hopes to do similar experiments with wild cats as well, to see whether her hunting hunch is right.
You have a minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
Not many scientific studies begin like this.
Many hours of watching YouTube clips, trying to find as many yawns as possible.
But for Andrew Gallup, an evolutionary psychologist who studies yawning at the State University of New York, it was all in a day's work. Gallup says yawns have traditionally been known as a sign of sleepiness or boredom.
But recent evidence suggests that yawning may function to promote brain cooling.
The idea being when you breathe in deeply, the incoming air slightly cools the brain. And stretching the jaw increases blood flow to the brain, too. The reason we do it at night?
At nighttime, when we're about to go to sleep, our brain and body temperatures are at their highest point during the day, and that's when we see highest frequency of yawning.
And so, Gallup and his colleagues found themselves hunting for cat videos on the internet. Along with clips of dogs, foxes, elephants, gorillas, hedgehogs, squirrels, rats, even walruses yawning. They timed all those yawns and then compared them to each species' average brain weight. Their conclusion, published in Biology Letters, was that the length of a yawn was a remarkably good predictor of an animal's brain weight, regardless of the size of its skull or jawbone.
Psychologist Saho Takagi, a graduate student at Kyoto University in Japan, strolls into one of Japan's many cat cafes. But Takagi isn't a typical customer. She's not there for feline affection, but to probe their minds. The psychology of domestic cats is still something of a mystery, despite our overwhelming familiarity with the critters. They have many skills, she tells me through an interpreter, that are not well known even to their owners. Takagi and her colleagues wanted to see whether domestic cats have an intuitive understanding of cause and effect. The cats, 30 of them, were shown a series of demonstrations. For example, a researcher would shake a box, accompanied by the sound of an object bouncing around inside. Then the cat would be allowed to see inside the container. If the cat expects to find a ball inside the box, it should stare longer if the box turns out to be empty, rather than if the ball was there as expected. If they expected a ball and were surprised not to find one, or vice versa, it suggests that cats have certain expectations about the physical realities of the world. And the cats did stare longer at those containers that violated their expectations, as if to suggest that they realized that something in the situation was amiss. Takaki suspects that this ability might be related to cats' hunting skills. Despite years of domestication, we initially kept them around as a form of pest control, so it makes sense that cats would have retained their knack for hunting. Eventually, she hopes to do similar experiments with wild cats as well, to see whether her hunting hunch is right.
There is half a minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task 2. Go on to task 3. You have a minute to read the task.
To Google. It's become a verb now. I Google, you Google, he, she, it Googles. And according to Nicholas Carr, Googling is changing the way that our brains work. He's the author of a much-cited article in The Atlantic magazine called Is Google Making Us Stupid? And the book that evolved from it, The Shallows. And he believes we're in danger of outsourcing our intellect to the internet.
We're coming to view the internet as kind of a substitute for our own mind. And we have access to pretty much unlimited amounts of information, but we also are constantly distracted, constantly interrupted, constantly dividing our attention. And that means that we get the benefits of having all this information, but we're losing, I think, our ability to think deeply, the kind of thinking that requires steady attention.
Talk to me about the difference between knowledge and intelligence, because the two are often mistaken for each other.
I think it's possible to be very intelligent in many ways without really having much knowledge at all. And I think this is one of the themes that comes out of the Flynn effect. What we've seen over the last 100 years is that we've become much more adept at scientific thinking, at abstract thinking. We're kind of trained in this as children. And yet at the same time, our knowledge, particularly in recent decades, our general store of information seems to be eroding. So we can figure out puzzles and we can do scientific experiments better than before, but our understanding of the world, of history, of government, of politics, of nature seems to be eroding at the same time.
I've just typed into the search bar of my laptop Elizabeth I of England because I realized I don't know when she reigned. 17 November 1558 to 24th of March 1603. Tell you when she was born. I can tell you everything you want to know about her. It's a couple of clicks away. Why do I need to fill up my brain with that knowledge when it's two clicks away?
There's a very big difference between thinking of memory, personal memory, as a collection of discrete facts, isolated facts, which is what we get when we Google stuff. You get lots of precise information very, very quickly. What personal knowledge comes from is not having access to a bunch of individual facts, whether the access is in your own mind or on the internet. Knowledge comes from the connections and the associations that a person forms among all the facts they know, among all the experiences they've had, among the feelings they felt. And this is the essence, I think, of what scientists refer to as memory consolidation. We create these rich connections and associations. So we don't just know facts about history. We have a context in which when we learn new facts, when we come across new facts, we plug those new facts into that context. It's out of that kind of big picture understanding of the world and of history that I think we reach our highest form of thinking and our highest form of intelligence. And that's different from Googling facts, as valuable as Googling facts is.
You have a minute now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
To Google. It's become a verb now. I Google, you Google, he, she, it Googles. And according to Nicholas Carr, Googling is changing the way that our brains work. He's the author of a much-cited article in The Atlantic magazine called Is Google Making Us Stupid? And the book that evolved from it, The Shallows. And he believes we're in danger of outsourcing our intellect to the internet.
We're coming to view the internet as kind of a substitute for our own mind. And we have access to pretty much unlimited amounts of information, but we also are constantly distracted, constantly interrupted, constantly dividing our attention. And that means that we get the benefits of having all this information, but we're losing, I think, our ability to think deeply, the kind of thinking that requires steady attention.
Talk to me about the difference between knowledge and intelligence, because the two are often mistaken for each other.
I think it's possible to be very intelligent in many ways without really having much knowledge at all. And I think this is one of the themes that comes out of the Flynn effect. What we've seen over the last 100 years is that we've become much more adept at scientific thinking, at abstract thinking. We're kind of trained in this as children. And yet at the same time, our knowledge, particularly in recent decades, our general store of information seems to be eroding. So we can figure out puzzles and we can do scientific experiments better than before, but our understanding of the world, of history, of government, of politics, of nature seems to be eroding at the same time.
I've just typed into the search bar of my laptop Elizabeth I of England because I realized I don't know when she reigned. 17 November 1558 to 24th of March 1603. Tell you when she was born. I can tell you everything you want to know about her. It's a couple of clicks away. Why do I need to fill up my brain with that knowledge when it's two clicks away?
There's a very big difference between thinking of memory, personal memory, as a collection of discrete facts, isolated facts, which is what we get when we Google stuff. You get lots of precise information very, very quickly. What personal knowledge comes from is not having access to a bunch of individual facts, whether the access is in your own mind or on the internet. Knowledge comes from the connections and the associations that a person forms among all the facts they know, among all the experiences they've had, among the feelings they've felt. And this is the essence, I think, of what scientists refer to as memory consolidation. We create these rich connections and associations. So we don't just know facts about history. we have a context in which when we learn new facts, when we come across new facts, we plug those new facts into that context. It's out of that kind of big picture understanding of the world and of history that I think we reach our highest form of thinking and our highest form of intelligence. And that's different from Googling facts, as valuable as Googling facts is.
There is half a minute now to finish the task. This is the end of task 3 and the whole listening test.